Can I just say what an honor it is to be here in this room with all of you? Because as far as I'm concerned, you are on the front lines of changing the world. It's no big surprise to you to recognize that we have a health crisis in this country and on this planet right now. Since 1975, the number of children who are overweight or obese has increased tenfold. In the last generation, the number of children who are hospitalized with a food allergy has increased fivefold in the United States in one generation. 70% of our population is now overweight or obese in America. This means you're kind of weird if you're just at a healthy body weight. It's become so systemic that we are all sick, that we take it for granted. Half of our elders, if you reach the age of 85, you have a 50% chance of dying with Alzheimer's disease. Meanwhile, with all that we know about how to prevent and reverse heart disease, it still killed 14 million people on this planet last year. And for all that we've spent on the war on cancer, most types of cancer have only increased in prevalence and even in mortality. We have a health crisis. And the status quo is to eat our way into sickness and then take drugs and surgery and become surgery patients to try to deal with the impact of diet and lifestyle-related choices. And you all are saying, hey, something else is possible. How do we prevent this so we don't have to get sick in the first place? And if we do get sick, how do we respond to it in ways that are creative, that see the body as a holistic organism? Because the reductionist mind looks at individual ailments and treats them with individual cures or remedies or perhaps even just symptom removers that ultimately create another cascade of side effects. No wonder the average senior in the United States is given 12 prescriptions every year for prescription drugs and is taking 5 of them at any given moment. The average senior in America right now. One drug causes one set of side effects, and then another drug deals with those, and then another drug deals with those, and before long we are in a toxic soup. And that's normal today. So while life expectancy has leveled off, health expectancy is going down. More and more people are living chronically sick. In fact, we have the most ill population in the history of the world, collectively. So that a lot of folks I know do not even look forward to growing old. They work their whole lives so they can retire, so that they can be in aches and pains and suffering and misery and lethargy and watch TV. What kind of life is that? And yet we all know that something else is possible, right? We all know that when we make certain diet and lifestyle choices, we can fuel health. We can not just add years to our lives, but we can add life to our years. And that's what I think this is all about, right? So we can shine. So we can be radiant embodiments of what we stand for and of what health can be for us and for our world. And I know that's what you want for your life and that's what you want for your patients. And I bless you for that and I honor you for that and I thank you for that. As Rita Marie mentioned, my grandfather founded an ice cream company. It's called Baskin Robbins. And my dad, John, grew up with an ice cream cone-shaped swimming pool in the backyard and 31 flavors of ice cream in the freezer. He was groomed to one day join in running the family company. And when he was in his early 20s, he was offered that chance. And he said no. And he walked away from a path that was practically paved with gold and ice cream to follow his own rocky road. He ended up moving with my mom to a little island off the coast of Canada where they built a one-room log cabin. They grew most of their own food. They practiced yoga and meditation for several hours a day, and they named their kid Ocean. They almost named me Kale, and this was before Kale was cool. So on behalf of my entire lifelong social journey, I am grateful they took the more conservative route when they named their son. But we did eat a lot of kale and cabbage and carrots and onions and other veggies that were growing right in the garden. And as I got a little older, we moved to California, and my dad began working on a book called Diet for a New America. It came out in 1987, and it inspired millions of people to look at their food choices as a chance to make a difference in the world. And the media had a lot of fun with the story. They called him the rebel without a cone. And his readers were all over the planet, and in the 5 years after Diet for a New America came out, beef consumption from industrialized feedlots in this country, the United States, dropped by 25%. On national radio, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association representative said it's his fault. And he didn't mean that as a compliment. But one of the people my dad's work ended up reaching, amazingly enough, was my grandfather. So my grandpa Irv had lost his brother-in-law, Bert Baskin, to heart disease when my dad's uncle Bert was 54 years old. I never knew my dad's uncle Bert because he was gone before I was born. I knew him from family stories, and I know he was one of the greatest entrepreneurs in American history. He had great wealth, he had a family he loved, but he didn't have his health, and eventually he lost his life. And he ate a lot of ice cream. He was a big guy. So now my grandpa, at the age of 70, was on a pretty similar trajectory. He was facing serious weight problems, heart problems, and type 2 diabetes. His doctors told him that he didn't have long to live, probably only a few years. They could just juggle his many medications to make his few remaining years a little more comfortable, unless he was willing to make some big changes. And then his doctor hands him a copy of a book called Diet for a New America. And my grandpa read it. Not the signed copy my dad had given him, mind you, but the copy the doctor gave him. And he made changes. He ended up cutting out sugar, giving up most of his animal products. He ended up giving up ice cream. And he ate a lot more vegetables and whole foods. He said, "I'm not a card-carrying vegetarian." I guess he was coming from the communist McCarthy days when you could be a card-carrying communist. He said, "I'm not a card-carrying vegetarian, but I'm eating a lot more vegetables." And guess what happened? He was a very methodical man. He tracked his results. He started getting down on his medications. He started getting off his medications. He lost a bunch of weight. He ended up getting off all of his diabetes and blood pressure medications, which he no longer needed. He reversed both conditions. He reversed his obesity. His golf game improved 7 strokes. He lived another 19 more healthy years. And so we have seen in our family what happens when we eat the standard American diet. We get the standard American diseases. But we've also seen what happens when we make a change. And I remember vividly when I was about 10 years old, my dad and I visiting my grandpa. No, I wasn't 10, I was about 15. I was a marathon runner at the time, and I remember us visiting him, and we were runners. We would run together, and he was out. He was well enough that he could take a morning walk every day for like an hour with his dog. And so we're jogging past him, and he's out on his morning walk with the dog, and he smiles and waves at us, and we're waving as we jog past him. And there was this feeling of like, this is what health can do, right? This is 3 generations out celebrating life, out living fully, out saying yes to life. And I'll never forget that memory. While my grandpa was finally on his deathbed, my dad and I were with him on his final day of life when he was 90. And I remember him saying to my dad, he said, "When you left Baskin-Robbins, I'll be honest, I thought you were crazy. And I might have been right." And he said, "But thank God some of us have lived long enough to learn a few new things." And then he looked at both of us and he said, "I want you to know I'm proud of you because you're helping people and you're making the world a better place." And, you know, I never had, my grandpa was not an overly effusive type of person. I never heard him say, "I love you," but I knew there was love in that moment. And, you know, if he could make those kinds of changes, he was one stubborn cookie. And he had more investment than most of us do in the status quo. In fact, he'd manufactured and sold more ice cream than anybody who'd ever lived. The last thing he would ever want to think is that he was hurting anybody. And so for him to make those kinds of changes and give up ice cream, you know, with all the investment he could have had in maintaining his previously held belief that there was no connection between what you eat and your health outcome, if he could make those changes, then there just might be hope for the rest of us too. He's one of my heroes. Now, let me ask you, how many of you are concerned about the spread of diabetes amongst our kids? How many of you are concerned about the rates of heart disease that continue to make it the number one killer on earth? How many of you are concerned about dementia and what's going to happen as seniors age and as baby boomers age? Okay. How many of you are concerned about the treatment of animals in today's factory farms? How many of you are concerned about topsoil and our ability to grow food for future generations? How many of you are concerned about our climate and its stability for future generations? Thank you. How many of you think you know why I'm asking all these questions? Because they're all connected. And because what we eat and how we live has an impact on all of these things. And this is, I think, one of the powerful things about food is that it's super personal. I mean, what you eat literally becomes you, right? At the same time, it's also very political, because what you eat has an impact all over the world on ecosystems, on animals, on the future generations that future generations will inherit, and so on farm workers. So everything, every bite you take is kind of a vote in a sense. We vote at the ballot box every so often, but we vote with our own knives and forks several times a day with our own food choices. And you get to cast a vote for the health you want and also for the world you want. And what I find really exciting about what I call the food revolution is that we get to take a stand with our food choices, and simple, consistent choices have very far-reaching implications. So let's take a look at that for a moment. For looking at cancer, we now know that processed meat, for example, is a carcinogen, according to the World Health Organization, right? We now know that higher rates of sugar and processed foods in general are associated with more cancer. We now know that certain foods are associated with lower rates of cancer. For example, one study of 2,000 women conducted by researchers at the University of Perth in Western Australia, they tracked these women. Half of them had previously had breast cancer, half had not. They looked at their diet and lifestyle extensively over many years. They ended up determining that those of women who consumed about a third of an ounce of mushrooms per day, the equivalent to like one button mushroom, had a 64% lower risk of breast cancer. When those same women also drank green tea daily, they dropped their risk of breast cancer by 89%. We also have studies showing us extraordinary health outcomes from turmeric. Some of you probably are familiar with turmeric. It can help bring down inflammation. It's associated with lower rates of Alzheimer's. Now, India has a far lower rate of Alzheimer's than we do in the United States, even when you adjust for life expectancy, because they do have lower life expectancy there. Far lower, though. Why? Well, it might be partly that half the population is vegetarian, but it might have something to do with the fact that they eat an average of about a teaspoon of turmeric per day in India. It's a huge part of the cuisine there. And so now we're seeing that when you mix turmeric with pepper and some kind of fat source, you increase bioavailability, and it's the curcuminoids in the turmeric that seem to be the most effective. It's fascinating, right? And so what is the power of turmeric and green tea and mushrooms, and is it possible that they don't just affect cancer or dementia? Well, no, of course they affect all kinds of things. They affect heart health. They affect life expectancy. The Loma Linda Health Study is probably unique amongst all epidemiological studies in health history, because this is a population in Southern California where the Seventh-day Adventists live. And there's, I think, about 150,000 people in Loma Linda. They're virtually all Seventh-day Adventists. And the Seventh-day Adventists adhere generally to a plant-based whole foods dietary philosophy. But not everybody sticks with it, because they are all living in the United States, and there's a lot of pulls in different directions, but about half of them do. So about half the population is following a whole foods plant-based dietary pattern, and about half is not, but they have similar religious orientation, and they have similar other lifestyle elements. They generally have a similar economic context. They're obviously living in the same environment with the same level of pollution. They're drinking the same water. So there are a lot of things about this that make it a fascinating testing ground. And fortunately, it has been studied very, very extensively. Loma Linda is the only blue zone in the United States. If you're not familiar with blue zones, Dan Buettner documented them for National Geographic, and he identified regions of the world where people live not just long lives, but very, very healthy lives right to the end. And so he looked at, you know, Sardinia, Italy, and Icarus, Greece, and the Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica, Loma Linda, California, and Okinawa, Japan. And he identified what these regions, how they were different and what they had in common. Interestingly, they all eat between 0 and 10% of calories from animal products, whereas the average American gets 34%. They all eat virtually no processed foods. In the United States, we get about 52% of our calories from processed foods or hyper-processed foods. They all get a lot of exercise. They all have strong social ties. They all have stress reduction built into the fabric of their lives, whether it's their faith or other elements. They have ways of calming their mind, calming their nervous system, attuning their consciousness to something that brings them peace. So these are all elements that correspond directly with the Ornish program, which the four pillars of the Ornish program, the only program proven to reverse heart disease in the United States, is, again, it's eat more, eat better, move more, stress less, and love more. Very similar, right? So back to Loma Linda, the only blue zone in America. They study these folks over the last, the study's ongoing, actually, but it's about 35 years downstream now. There's a lot of data. And what we're seeing is that those folks in Loma Linda, when at the age of 65, if they're eating a whole foods plant-based diet, their life expectancy is about 11 years more than the ones who are not. Overall, Loma Lindans outlive the rest of the United States by, I think, about 6 or 7 years. My friends, Drs. Dean and Ayesha Sherzai, are neurologists. They're two of the most senior neurologists in the United States. They've been practicing in Loma Linda for over 30 years, and they have diagnosed over 3,000 Alzheimer's patients, almost all of them Loma Lindans, almost all of them Seventh-day Adventists, over 3,000 patients over the course of their practice. And what they have noted is that, again, Loma Linda is about 50% whole foods plant-based, 50% not. So how many of the 3,000 patients that they have diagnosed with Alzheimer's do you think were whole foods plant-based? 19 out of 3,000. So that's anecdotal. It's not like something you could really, you know, who chose to come to them and why and whatever. But the plural of anecdotal is data. And when you have that much information, I think it's pretty fascinating. So the Sherzais have concluded, based on extensive research, that we could prevent 90% of cases of Alzheimer's with a whole foods, plant-centered diet, exercise, strong social ties, and stress reduction. Dr. Ornish, meanwhile, is telling us we could prevent probably about 90% of cases of heart disease with the exact same four principles. Meanwhile, we're hearing study after study showing us, when we look at cancer, that only 5 or 10% of cancer cases are caused by genetics. 90 to 95% are caused by a combination of diet, lifestyle, and environmental factors. What do we mean by diet? We mean sugar and hyper-processed foods and excessive animal products, especially processed meats. What do we mean by lifestyle? We mean not moving enough. What do we mean by environment? We're talking, and smoking, too, right? Smoking's huge with cancer. And then what do we mean by environment? We're talking about the environmental contaminants, air, water, all the plastics, all of the stuff around us that can become toxic in our bodies. So you put all that together and you say, wow, what's possible? And then we know that diabetes, type 2 diabetes, is almost directly linked to diet and lifestyle, right? And most diabetes is type 2 now because it's growing so fast. So you put all that together and you say, well, if you eat a healthy diet and you exercise and you have strong social ties and, you know, you have stress reduction in your life, then what the heck are you going to die of? Maybe we'll just ripen. Well, here's what I think when we look at the blue zones. People do die. Everyone dies. Life is a terminal diagnosis. But the question is, what's possible for longevity, number one, and number two, what's possible for quality of life if we put these principles into action? And the answer is, I'd like to find out. I think we get to be a part of a social experiment of sorts, of people who know more about what the data tells us than any population that's ever lived. And if we can apply that, the sky's the limit, I think. Not necessarily that we'll live forever, but we'll live so fully, so richly, that when the end does come, we feel completely satisfied, completely at peace, like we did everything we came for, and we enjoyed the journey. That's what I want for my life. So one of the things I notice about food is that it connects us to a lot of people and practices and policies around the world. And as I was working on 31-Day Food Revolution, I got to talk to some fascinating people. One of the people I got to connect with was a man by the name of Craig Smith. Craig is was a chicken farmer in North Carolina. And he was growing chickens. He had a barn, he had a couple barns, he had about 30,000 birds. He'd been doing this for about 25, 30 years. And he was struggling to make ends meet. He was working with Purdue. Purdue is the largest chicken processor in America. And the way it works, it's kind of an interesting relationship where he would provide the land, build the barns, follow their protocols precisely. He would buy the equipment from them, get financing for the barn building. They would provide him with the baby chicks and the feed. He would buy all that from them and finance it, and then he would sell them the meat at the end. And he ended up clearing about 5 cents a pound on the chicken meat that he produced. So it was tough to make ends meet, and it took him decades to work his way out of debt from getting it all set up. Craig was not treating his chickens too terribly well. He did exactly what they said to do. So the average bird had about 1 square foot per bird for birds that have a 3-foot wingspan, so they could never lift a single wing by the time they got to be full grown. They were bred to be morbidly obese. So by the time they were 3 months old, it was kind of the equivalent of if a human infant was to weigh 600 pounds. They couldn't walk because they were so bloated, and so they would just lie on the ground, and they would lie in feces. Not just their feces, but the feces of generations of birds before them, because the barn was cleared every 3 years or so of fecal material. They were forbidden from ever opening windows. That was actually in the contract with Purdue, because that would create more stimulation and the birds would move more, and that would bring down the feed conversion ratio. They were also forbidden from ever giving them any natural light. Light had to be completely controlled, and natural light, again, would stimulate them too much. So no natural light, no open windows, no fresh air ever, sitting in fecal material all day long. Their feathers would fall off because they would develop sores. Their feathers would fall off against the fecal material all day long, and then about 5% of them were actually dead by the time it was time to kill them. So the chicken barn was littered with dead bodies all around, lying in poop. And Craig was not happy with having to do this to make a living, but he didn't see a way out. Then one day he sees an ad on television, and it's Jim Purdue. And he's saying, we treat our chickens well, and they're healthy, and they're happy, and that makes good meat. And Craig says, I'm no psychologist, but I don't think these birds are happy. I'm not a vet, but I can tell you they're not healthy. And I might be a chicken farmer, but I'm no liar. And if I don't say something, then he's speaking for me, and I'm lying to the world. So he did something very, very bold. He invited Compassion in World Farming, which is an animal rights, animal welfare organization, to come in with cameras and film his award-winning Purdue chicken operation. He'd been inspected weekly by Purdue. He'd won numerous awards, and they filmed it, and he showed the scene. He showed the dead bodies. He showed these sores. He showed the feathers falling off. He showed the poop underneath everybody. He showed how the birds were living, and he just described what he was seeing. And this video was posted on YouTube, and it went crazy viral. And it became a national news story. Because this wasn't some undercover investigator showing a bad apple. This was an award-winning producer inviting the cameras in to show what's normal in the industry. And Purdue was not happy. They had some battles. They had some issues. Within a year, Craig Watts said, all right, I am out of this. And he got out of the chicken business, and he's now growing crops on his land for human consumption. But more to the point, he has changed his career path. He's actually renting the land out for crop growers, and he has become a consultant, and he now helps factory farmers to transition to healthier and more humane livelihoods. Yeah. Craig is one of my heroes. And he doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of education, but he's got a lot of heart. And he was willing to risk everything to tell the truth so that we could know the truth. I've talked to some folks who work for Mercy for Animals and some of the other organizations that do conduct undercover investigations. And I want you to imagine this for a second. There are people who care about the welfare of animals so much that they want us to know what's really happening in our factory farms. See, the industry doesn't make it easy. There are ag gag laws in a bunch of states that literally make it illegal to photograph factory farms. National Geographic photographer who traveled the world taking pictures of food production. He'd been through Iran and Libya and a lot of places, but the only time he ever got arrested was in Kansas, when he flew over a feedlot in a hang glider, because they wouldn't let him in through the front door. And when he landed, he was taken off to jail. Yeah. So they don't want us to know. But there are individuals who care so much about animals that they are willing to undercover at enormous risk to their security, take a job bashing in the brains of cows all day long, torturing pigs, essentially, cutting off their tails, you know, so that when they go crazy, they won't bite each other's rears off. Cutting off the beaks of chickens so they won't peck each other to death when they go insane under excessively close quarters. They'll still peck, but they won't be able to kill each other because their beaks are gone. And they take these jobs, and then at some point along the way, they manage to sneak in a camera, and they take some pictures, knowing that they could go to jail for doing so. And then they show those pictures, and the world finds out what's happening. But here's the really intense thing. If you or I were to treat a dog or a cat the way that's normal in these factory farms, we'd go to jail. In every state in this country, there are laws against cruelty to animals. But in every state in this country, they specifically exempt animals raised for food. So this means that as long as something is normal, as long as it's standard practice, it's completely acceptable. And cruelty has become institutionalized to the point that if you don't do it, you can't compete in the marketplace. Because all of these practices have a cost benefit of some kind embedded in it, at least in the short term. So whenever these stories come out, if it's normal, it isn't even news. And if they find a bad apple, something that's aberrant and outside the norm, then maybe there'll be a citation or a fine. Maybe that particular operation will even be shut down, and this happens. But a lot of these people who take these jobs are traumatized by what they've undergone. And what they notice is that their coworkers are far more traumatized. So did you know that suicide rates amongst slaughterhouse workers are about the highest of any profession in the world? A lot of these people have PTSD, like higher rates than our military. And yet many of them are very poor when they take these jobs as a last resort. I don't know anybody who would like to have a job working in a factory farm. But when there aren't any other options, some people are desperate to feed their families or to stay afloat, and they'll do whatever it takes. And that's the job that's available to them. So in these conditions, one of the things that happens is that there are a lot of bacteria breeding, and the animals are pumped full of antibiotics. To keep them alive, they're given antibiotics with every dose of feed. And they're also given antibiotics for another reason. The industry has found out that animals who are pumped full of antibiotics gain weight faster, which increases the profitability of their flesh. So antibiotic use is so widespread that 80% of the antibiotics used in the United States are not given to people, they're given to livestock. Worldwide, it's about 66%. You may be aware of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. It's a growing epidemic. It killed 30,000 Americans last year, 700,000 people worldwide. And we are looking at a possible post-antibiotic world within a generation as the most powerful medicines ever developed by allopathic medicine may become impotent. Why? Because of the prevalence of antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and our factory farms have essentially become breeding grounds for them. You could say that they're biological weapons factories. We are producing bacteria in these factory farms that killed 30,000 Americans last year, that could kill us hundreds of thousands annually within a generation. So it's kind of a case of the chickens coming home to roost, so to speak. When we treat animals in this way and we pump them full of antibiotics to keep them alive, we then create these bacteria which in turn threaten our lives. But of course, we're also producing products from these factory farms that study after study is showing us are not healthy for human beings. Animals raised in these conditions produce meat and milk and eggs that are not the same as animals that are happy and eat grass and see the sunshine and live in a natural environment. Not at all. And yet our enormous, voracious appetite for meat almost necessitates these conditions, because it would not be possible to produce the amount of meat that we are eating in this country on a global scale on the land that we have. Right now, on planet Earth, 83% of all agricultural land is being used for livestock production, producing 33% of the world's protein and 19% of the world's calories. 83% of the land. You see, anytime you move up the food chain, you get some inefficiency, because animals eat a lot of calories of whatever vegetation they're eating, whether it's grass or corn or soy, and they don't turn all that into flesh, right? So it takes land to produce those calories, and then they end up in that animal's body. And it takes about 12 pounds of grain or soy to produce 1 pound of feedlot beef in the United States today. It takes about 7 pounds for a pound of pork and 4 pounds for a pound of chicken. It's like a protein factory in reverse. And so all of this land, of course, is having an impact on our environment. It has to be irrigated in many places, even pasture. In my state of California, all grass-fed beef, if they're eating in the summertime, our grass turns brown in the summer. So what are they going to eat? Well, they're going to be eating either irrigated pasture, or they're going to be eating, you know, something grown somewhere else, right? That's brought in. The net impact of this is that a pound of beef in America takes about 2,000 gallons of water, according to National Geographic. It's like a stack of gallon jugs almost half a mile high for 1 pound of beef, average. Takes a lot of land. So the single biggest driving force behind the destruction of the tropical rainforests right now is beef production. You may have heard of the president of Brazil and the burning of the rainforests in the Amazon right now. They're on fire at a terrifying rate. These fires have generally been started by humans who were clearing land for, guess what, cattle grazing. So there's a connection between the food on our plates and the tropical rainforests, between the food on our plates and our water supplies, which is a terrifying thing, by the way, because over 1 billion human beings right now are completely dependent on aquifers for their water, and those aquifers are being depleted far faster than they're replenishing. There's a connection between the food on our plate and our topsoil. According to UN researchers, we have 60 years of farmable soil left on Earth, We're depleting our topsoil 10 times faster than it can replenish. It takes nature about 1,000 years to produce 3 centimeters of topsoil. We are washing it away in our rivers and streams because of unsustainable farming practices. It has a lot to do with industrialized farming, the use of chemical fertilizers. We're killing the soil with pesticides. And all of this is designed to produce as much food as possible to feed humanity. But when we take 12 pounds of grain or soy to produce 1 pound of feedlot beef, it takes a lot more food to keep that system going. So when people talk about, oh, organics are not as productive per acre in the short term and we can't afford it, I say, well, yes, we get about 10% less yield for organic agriculture in the short term, although in the long term it's sustainable. Where will we be in 60 years? There's a big difference between having soil and not having soil. How productive is a depleted desert going to be? Right? So organic agriculture is very important in the long term, but even in the short term, if you're really concerned about world hunger, why don't we eat less meat so that we can have more land to grow food for humans? And also, by the way, if you're thinking about climate change, remember this, the UN reports that agriculture is responsible for about 14% of net total carbon emissions and overall greenhouse gas emissions, 14%. That means essentially that cows impact our climate more than cars, because the vast majority of the agriculture is climate impact is coming from cows. Now, what's fascinating is that regenerative agriculture is growing as a concept, and what we're finding is that we can actually farm carbon. We can actually take carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the soil where it belongs, and then we can replenish our topsoil. We can have more nutrients. We can have more resilient land. We can have more land that is more adaptable to droughts and floods, that can respond to even the changes of climate change more effectively, and we could actually make it into a carbon sink. This is very exciting stuff. And there's a lot, you may hear a lot about the use of livestock production in regenerative agriculture, and there are some breakthroughs around this. We could produce a relatively small amount of meat in a much, much, much more sustainable way, perhaps even a way that is of net benefit to our climate if we apply these very specific principles, and we absolutely should be doing that. Here's the thing, though. It takes a lot of land to do that, and there is no way we could produce enough meat for the global human population in this way. So we have to eat less meat, and for those who do eat it, we have to eat better meat. And that's just the future, what it's going to take so that my kids and your kids and our grandkids can actually have a world to live in, can actually grow food at all. But the beautiful news, I think, is that the same food choices that say no to this kind of cruelty to animals and that say no to this kind of environmental destruction and that say no to cancer and Alzheimer's and heart disease and diabetes and obesity are the very same food choices that we all have the power to make and to advocate. So when you're working with patients, I want you to remember that we are part of a global human community and a global ecological community, and I want you to remember that I believe that as a human being of conscience in the world that we live in, we are not just isolated consumers. We are connected to the commons. We are connected to the world around us. And as such, there is a world of difference between looking at the world and feeling cynical and overwhelmed by all the problems going on out there and saying, oh my God, I can't solve every problem, so I'll just focus on me. And you know what? Your heart shrinks when you do that. And on the other hand, when you say, I get to be a part of something bigger, I get to know that I'm part of the solution, then your life has a greater sense of meaning and purpose. Then you know that your life is contributing in some way to building a better and a brighter future. And that sense of purpose, I believe, is one of the most important ingredients to health, to true lasting wellness. George Bernard Shaw said it quite well. He said, this is the true joy in life, to be used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, to be a force of nature instead of a feverish clot of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. He said, I'm a member of the community, and as a member, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can before I die. Life is no brief candle to me. It's more of a splendid torch, which I want to burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. So I want to thank you for burning your candle or your torch as brightly as you can, and I want to thank you for all the steps you take to be a member of the community. And I want to encourage you as you're working with people and supporting people in their very intimate, very personal health journeys to remember that they too are a member of the community and that we are all affected by the community and we all get to participate in contributing to the community. And it is my experience that the greatest remedy for cynicism and despair is action. I used to travel the United States. I spoke in school assemblies for hundreds of thousands of young people in high schools across the U.S. And we would ask in school after school, raise your hand if you believe the world will be a better place in a generation with less violence and less pollution. And we would watch in school after school as 1% of the hands would go up. And my heart just ached that a whole generation of young people had so little hope for their own future. And we would ask, raise your hand if you want the world to be a better place in a generation, and every hand would go up, of course, right? But then something fascinating happened. We would also meet with environmental clubs and social justice clubs and animal rights clubs on those campuses. And what we found was when we asked that same question with those students, almost every hand would go up. And they knew more about the problems than everybody else, but they were doing something positive. And it came to occur to me that hope isn't a noun. It's a verb. It's not something that comes from analyzing the data, because God help us, if we analyze the data, we get really cynical. But it comes from participating in making new data, participating in being an agent of change in the world. And we can do that at the micro level. You know, you can eat yourself into oblivion and feel cynical and despair about your health future, and then plan to take a bunch of drugs to try to eke out a few more years. And when you're in that state, you're actually drawn to junk foods because they provide some fleeting momentary pleasure. Or you can say, I'm loving this precious body. I'm part of contributing to my own health and wellness. And in the process, something fundamental changes. You know, the placebo effect is a powerful force. And I've always thought, how do we leverage that, right? Not with a bunch of sugar pills, but actually the power of belief, the power of consciousness, to shape health outcome. And so one of the things I think you do when you help a patient to have hope, when you help a patient to take positive steps, is you get them to send a message through their whole entire organism that says, I love me, I'm worth caring for, I'm worth cherishing, I'm worth standing up for. And when we do that, I think we become more whole, more beautiful, more happy, more alive humans. And so I want to just speak a word to the power of love, the power of intention, the power of self-care. And of course, it matters what we do to care for ourselves. But we see a lot of studies where people make a dietary change of some kind and they get some kind of benefit. And it almost doesn't matter what they're doing. A lot of them are going to get short-term benefit just because of the power of consciousness. Of course, in the long term, it does matter what they're doing, which is why you want to be informed and set them on a right path. But there is an incredible potency and power to helping people do anything that is an activation on behalf of their own self-interest or the collective self-interest. So I thank you for that. I want to tell you about another of my heroes. Her name is Kate McGowie-Smith from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Kate was in pretty bad shape. She had three kids between the ages of 11 and 17. She was diagnosed with a severe heart condition and lung condition such that she couldn't breathe without being hooked up to a 20-pound oxygen tank. She was diagnosed with diabetic retinopathy. She was 120 pounds overweight, and she lost her vision. She was in such bad shape that she couldn't walk, so she was stuck in a wheelchair. Her doctors told her only hope of survival would be a lung transplant, and the odds of that were pretty low. She probably only had a few years left, and they specifically told her, make sure you have a good will written up for your kids because they might not have a mother much longer. She had to have the most heartbreaking conversation I think any mother could have with her children, which was to let them know that she might be dead really soon. Then she watched a movie called Forks Over Knives. And she got inspired about a whole foods plant. Well, she didn't watch it, by the way, but she heard it, to be more precise. But she got inspired about the power of a whole foods plant-based diet, and she took it very, very seriously. So she taught herself to cook in a wheelchair, blind, and hooked up to a 20-pound oxygen tank. She ate greens 6 times a day, and she went completely whole foods, plant-based. She got pretty remarkable results. Kate lost 120 pounds. She reversed her diabetes. She got her eyesight back. She got her mobility back. She got out of her wheelchair. Now she walks for miles. She got her breathing back and her heart function back. She doesn't need a lung transplant. She still has seriously depleted kidney function. She has 12% kidney function, one of the lifelong impacts from the diabetes, and that's not likely to ever return. But she hasn't needed dialysis because her diet and her lifestyle are so pure. And she's a living miracle. And now she's become a health coach. She started Fork Smart, and she's trying to help other people on this path. Maybe some of you can relate to this kind of story. Maybe for a lot of people in this room, your own journey personally has affected your desire to help others. Certainly that's the case for Kate. Her story, however, is pretty dramatic. When I was talking with her, she shared with me that partly because of all that she's been through and partly because of the kidney issue she's facing today, she still doesn't take her life for granted at all. And mortality is a very real thing for her. And she thinks about her kids and what she's leaving them quite a bit. And she doesn't have much money. She said, I don't expect to be able to leave them much of anything financially, but I think I'm leaving them something far more important, which is a living legacy of health. And it's true. You see, her son was also on a similar path. He followed her example. He's lost 70 pounds. Her husband has reversed his diabetes. So what we do sends out ripples, and it affects families and ecosystems all around the world. And Kate is one of my heroes, because I don't know about you, but sometimes I can feel kind of, I can kind of complain and mope a little bit about things that aren't going the way I want, you know? And then I think about Kate. There she was, blind, in a wheelchair, hooked up to a 20-pound oxygen tank on which she depended for her every breath. And there she was, teaching herself to cook, eating greens 6 times every day. And if she could face those kinds of challenges and make the right choices, then what excuse do we have, right? And so I remind you of that too when you're working with patients and you're trying to inspire people, some of whom may have very little hope. There's the saying that pain pushes and vision pulls. So some people will be fundamentally motivated by fear, by the desire to survive, by the pain they're in and desire to be free from that pain. And some people will be motivated by vision, by possibility, by what they want for their lives. And wherever someone is in their life journey, you find what motivates them. You find what makes them tick. And for some younger folks, it's actually more concerned about the world around them. You know, my kids could care less about heart disease and cancer. They don't think that's even possible for them. But they care about the world. They care about not wanting animals to be tortured in factory farms. They care about how farm workers are treated as well and don't want to contribute to pesticide poisoning for farm workers. They've learned about this stuff. They don't want children growing chocolate in Ivory Coast to be in slavery. So for them, saying, I want fair trade chocolate, for them saying, I don't want to eat animal products, especially anything from factory farms, is a moral issue. And it helps them feel like at peace with the world, to know that they're part of the solution. So you find what works for people and what motivates people, and you help them on the path. But the beautiful thing is that in this case, with our food choices, it's not a choice between the lesser of two evils. We really can have our healthy date and nut cake and eat it too. Yeah. So I think we have some time for questions. Why don't we go ahead and move into that? There's there's one mic at the back of the room there, two of them. So if you have any questions you want to ask me, now's a great time for it.
And before we do, before we do that, let's give Ocean a huge round of applause for such inspiration and so much dedication. And I want to actually ask the first question.
Okay.
All right. So when we last met, which is just about a month, not even a month ago, you were talking about the work that you're doing with the medical school exit exams.
Yeah.
And I think that everybody here would really love to hear that.
Okay. So, In Food Revolution Network, we've been looking at what are the policy changes and the systemic changes that can make the biggest difference. So it doesn't feel like an uphill battle just to do the right thing for your health or your family. And one of the things we looked at is nutritional education in medical school. So the average physician in all their years of medical training gets 19 hours of nutritional education, and most of that focuses on specific nutritional deficiencies and the outcomes that they lead to, and doesn't actually focus at all on helping patients eat well. Out of every medical school in America, there are only 5 that have a single dedicated faculty for nutrition. And so most doctors know virtually nothing. I mean, you will know more just from what you learn here than the average MD has learned in all of their training. Like, vastly more, actually, you know, because it's accurate, too, right? What we started getting at was, how do we change this? And so we went to some doctors, and we were like, well, we get really busy in our practices, and we weren't taught it in school, and it's hard. You have to do extra work to learn it later. And then we said, well, we went to some medical schools. And they said, oh, my God, we have so much we have to teach our doctors in order to get them to, our students, in order to get them to pass the graduating exams. There's just a lot of stuff they got to learn. We got to pack it full, and they're working so hard. How are we going to add more to their plates? And we said, well, what's on the exams that you're teaching? Because they teach to the test, just like any school. And they said, oh, well, there's 10,000 questions in the bank of questions on the exams. It's put out by the National Board of Medical Examiners. So then we reached out to the National Board of Medical Examiners. We said, okay, how many of your 10,000 questions in your bank focus on whole foods nutrition and helping patients eat well? They said, oh, maybe none. So naturally, we decided that was the point of focus. So we launched a campaign, and we created a petition calling on the National Board of Medical Examiners to make at least 5% of the 10,000 questions in that bank focus on nutrition, and particularly the value of whole foods, plant-centered nutrition to support patient health. And we got people to sign this, like major figures, deans of medical schools, and major leaders that would be respected by the NBME. And then we approached them again. We worked with the American College of Lifestyle and Medicine on this campaign, by the way. They're a major partner in this. We approached them again, and they basically said, okay, we're willing to add them to the bank of questions if you write them and provide us with acceptable questions for the bank. And so then we launched an initiative to find the right people to write those questions, and the American Board of Lifestyle Medicine is now guiding this process, and we have to raise some money for it. $250 per question is what they need to pay the actual qualified, credible people who will write these questions. So it's a $250,000 fundraising campaign. We've already raised about $50,000, so that's about 200 questions, and we got about 800 to go. The math might be a little off, but that's about where we're at. And so we're underway. We've just started the fundraising a couple months ago, and I'm pretty excited about it because this could change the course of medical education.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yay. So if anybody has questions, there's 2 mics. You need to come up to one of the 2 mics and ask your question at the mic. And what you would be...
Melinda has a medical school, and I'm wondering if they... actually focus more on nutrition and what that education is like for those doctors.
Interesting. I haven't looked into it. My gut says probably yes, because I know quite a few people at the Loma Linda Medical School are active in promoting the kinds of things we're talking about today. But I haven't looked into it in any depth.
One of our speakers tomorrow, Dr. Alan Hopkins, that's where he went to medical school, so you can ask
him.
Great,
we can ask him. Yeah, great, great. Let me go ahead and share with you, and feel free to jump in if you have more questions, but let me go ahead and share with you, speaking of the medical school campaign, gets me thinking about what are the other things that could create systemic change on a big scale. And let me tell you a few of those. We could change government policy so we stop subsidizing junk food. And let me just tell you how bad it is. So we have a farm bill in the United States, and taxpayers are funding, essentially, subsidizing big agriculture. But not just every form of big agriculture. We are primarily subsidizing what's called commodities crops, with tens of billions of dollars in taxpayer subsidies. And the commodities crops that are being subsidized are primarily wheat and corn and soy. And so most of that corn and soy are going to livestock feed, to high fructose corn syrup, to ethanol for our cars. And we're not talking about popcorn here, although that's maybe in the mix a little bit. But essentially, we're bringing down the price of things like high fructose corn syrup, factory-farmed animal products, and Wonder Bread. Doritos has 14 subsidized ingredients. And we're talking about a significant economic impact. So it really does bring down the price of these things. The entire factory farming system is fundamentally based on cheap corn and soy that is genetically engineered, by the way, to feed to livestock. And so one of the things we're saying is, let's shift this. If we're going to subsidize anything, shouldn't we be subsidizing fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and, you know, the foods we should be eating more of, right? Instead of subsidizing the junk food? Because right now it's kind of like you're being fined for wearing your seatbelt. And, you know, Whole Foods has gotten the unfortunate nickname Whole Paycheck. There is something to it, which is that for a lot of folks who want to move in a healthier direction, it actually costs more. Now, we can make the case very clearly and strongly, I think, that you're going to pay it one way or the other, and better to spend it on food that's healthy than to spend it on days lost from work, from being sick, on brain fog, and ultimately on drugs and surgeries and premature death. But in the short run, it feels like it could cost more to do the right thing for your body. And partly, their taxpayers are on the hook for that. So we're trying to shift that, to expose that, and to call for that. I think in this administration, it's not going to be too easy. But we do take some heart in trying to help food become part of the political conversation in the United States. And this isn't just an American issue, by the way. All of the OECD nations have the equivalent worldwide, about 33% of overall, about 33% of the cost of the commodities crops is subsidized in OECD nations by taxpayers or governments. Yeah. So it's a global issue. And the good news is we can do something about it. Another thing we could do if we wanted to would be to support more school gardens and more community gardens and more backyard gardens. There are so many studies showing that when kids grow vegetables, they eat vegetables. And there are also studies now showing us that putting your hands in the dirt is good for your microbiome. That it actually, that bacteria, when it's healthy dirt, and interacting with it is actually healthy for your whole organism. That your skin is part of your body, and it actually, the microbiome technically includes the skin, right? And when you are in contact with the living earth, instead of just sterile plastics all day long, you actually absorb some of that, and it enhances your overall diversity. And some of that, of course, ends up in your mouth, but some of it just connects to your whole organism, and it's a really good thing. So now we're seeing studies showing that jumping in cold water, jumping in mountain creeks, touching dirt, playing in the mud, turns out to be good for your health. Yippee. Pretty cool. Yeah. So school gardens could be a big step, and community gardens, and we could grow a lot of our food there. In the United States, if we just turned our lawns into vegetable gardens nationwide, we'd grow about four times more vegetables than we do right now. Yeah. That's how much land there is growing for lawns right now. Mm-hmm. We could turn all that into vegetables and look at the abundance we'd have.
And let me just add to that, I'm going to go to your question. Some of the stuff that we're killing off, like dandelions, which grow naturally. Yeah. They just grow, and we can, so you turn your lawn, don't pull the dandelions out or put stuff in to kill them. Throw that out there, purslane, lamb's quarters, all this stuff grows. They're considered weeds. They are the most nutritious foods on the planet.
Yeah.
So throw some dandelion seeds out in your lawn.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
So I don't know if it's so much of a question, but there's so many topics in what you're talking about. So how does the average person I do grow my own garden. Like, I'm worried about what's in the chemicals in the lawns of the people that are next to me that are spraying Roundup and things. How do you get to the source of what you're doing is healthy enough for yourself? Like, how do you improve your soil? Like, how can you add things that will ultimately help your own, you know, own lot?
Yeah. Well, the biggest, like amazing miracle we're just wasting right now is compost. I mean, I think something like 40% of our landfill space is compost. And that is an incredibly precious resource. I mean, nature doesn't have waste. Everything gets reused. And all of our organic matter can be composted. And that will replenish our soil. So some cities, I think even Austin has a composting program it's developing. So that's wonderful if you can do that. But you can also compost in your own backyard. And there are ways to do it that don't have to be super smelly. And you end up with wonderful dirt on the other side. And that can go back into the soil and back into the earth. And it's a wonderful way of being a part of the solution. It's great for kids to get to see how life works and how nature is a closed-loop system that just keeps reusing. And one generation of death becomes the next generation of life on earth. And so getting to feel that and be part of that is wonderful. Soil is... I think the greatest crisis nobody's really talking about, the depletion of our topsoil, is also depleting the mineral content and the nutritive value of our food. So vegetables are, you know, down by about 25% over the last couple generations in terms of the overall nutrients they have, some nutrients more, some less, but that's the cumulative, and that has a pretty big impact on our health, right? So you have to eat more vegetables than ever now if you want to be really healthy and, you know, get the results. But replenishing our soil, we can go the other direction, and we can have super nutrient-rich food. So I think growing anything is really helpful, even if it's a little thing in your windowsill, like some herbs, a tomato plant, feeling some connection to the cycles of life, feeling some connection to where your food comes from. And one of the things it does, if you have, anybody who's ever had a garden realizes how hard farmers work, you know? And we can respect that, and we'll appreciate our food more when we realize that so much labor went into it, and we don't just take it for granted. And we really say, wow, I'm grateful to all of the soil and sun and water and rain and the farm workers and all the labor that went into making this food possible for me right now. And when you appreciate your food more and you have more gratitude, then I think that creates more saliva, and it also creates more of a sense of connection to the web of life. So we feel like we are more woven into the web of life rather than isolated consumers. And that is a paradigm shift that fundamentally rearranges our place in the world. And I think it's critical to a sense of holistic wellness to feel at home on this planet. And we feel a sense of place when we feel connected to where our food comes from. Yeah.
First, I want to say thank you to you for your amazing talk. I love the way you connected factory farming, climate change, and how... making good choices there impact how we eat, you know. So that was great. And I wanted to share both a little story and a comment about composting. First little story was I was blessed with a wonderful mother who had a garden on the front lawn when, you know, way back, 60s, 70s. and she used to do things that we thought were crazy when we were kids, you know, bury her eggshells and we would go down to the beach and collect fish heads and algae, and she'd bring it back and bury it, and shells. She said the soil needed calcium. Fireplace ashes were good for the roses. So, you know, everything, yes, in nature's recycled. But another comment about composting and whatnot is that in New York City we have green markets, and I don't know how many people have them out there in their communities. But it's a great place to get organic produce, and I can bring my compost there because I'm kind of lazy myself, despite having a mom like that. I'm, you know, not always composting, so I've started to bring my compost there, and green markets. So they're a great, you know, resource to support in communities.
Great, wonderful, thank you. Yeah, yes.
Awesome. So I also wanted to say thank you for your talks and. The content here has been incredible, so thank you for delivering a message so crisply and clearly. I also wanted to add, because one of the things that worked for me when I was a meat eater, and also when I transitioned from eating meat, and then also had to help my dad, who I almost lost to triple bypass surgery, who then became a pre-diabetic after the surgery. And one of the things that I think is a message that I think we're sort of you articulated really nicely the problem. And we all, I think America now knows we need to stop eating these kinds of meats, right? But I think there's a big issue too that needs to be addressed, which is how do you deal with the fixation of meat, which is what I found. Even though it's an N of one, I found that I love the texture of meat. And that, and it's kind of like if you're a smoker, you understand 80% of the habit is this here, from the hand to the mouth. And so what I found out was, you know, I couldn't stop eating meat, right? So I was grateful when I found all of these meat alternatives that were coming to the market, Beyond Burgers and a few of other, you know, the ones that are out there. And so while a lot of hardcore vegans would disagree with that, hey, it's not a whole food plant-based diet, I was able to reverse my dad's pre-diabetes with this alternative processed meat. The studies haven't been done yet, right? But if you combine the right ratios of a big salad, mixed greens, veggies, and you have that Gardein chicken with a Beyond Burger, or it could be a half of it, or, you know, I think this is an important message because you can transition slowly, you know, and that's the problem. People go, how do I get, I love the texture, I love the fixation, how am I, what's going to replace that? And so I think there's a, it's a really missing piece in the message that I think those things are great transitional foods. And it, and in terms of the impact, as you alluded to, one of the biggest impacts we could have today for the environment, for the world, and for our human existence is to go plant-based. And this is a great segue into that. So thank you for your message.
I mean, it's a journey for a lot of people, and I'm not interested in a diet plan that people go on for a little while and then they go back to their other way of living, right? Like, it's your habits that chart your destiny more than anything else. So how do we create healthy habits that we can stick with and also take one step? People say, where should we go? And I'm like, take a step in the right direction and then take another step and then keep going and keep moving and keep developing new habits. You know, you find one recipe that's healthy that you love and you make it every few days and you get to know it. And then you add another one to your starting rotation. And eventually it becomes habituated and you keep going like that. Now, some people go cold turkey, and that makes sense in certain situations. But other times, it's a journey. It's a gradual process of getting comfortable and familiar. And sometimes, in the long run, that's more sustainable. Now, we could certainly have, I'm sure, a spirited debate about the meat alternatives and the pros and cons of them. And, you know, at one level, processed food is processed food. At another level, I do believe that for some people, they can provide a stepping stone, right? Especially if they're used to the meat products and they can move gradually in a direction, and then maybe eventually they're using some seasoned tempeh, and then eventually, you know, there's just a step, there's a process, right? I do want to put out a word of caution about the Impossible Burger, which is that it's totally dependent on GMOs for its production, and the Beyond Meat is not. They're non-GMO, but the Impossible Burger is totally based on GMOs, and we could have a whole talk about GMOs. I don't know if we have time for that, but
we have some questions from the
actually,
live stream.
This is perfect.
This is perfect.
Okay.
This is perfect, and I know you could do a whole another conference just on that topic. But the question is, what is your take on GMO?
All right.
Well,
okay.
There you go.
Well, there you go. Okay. So a lot of people think GMO means God move over. It doesn't. It means genetically modified organism, also called genetic engineering. And it's where scientists in labs have spliced together the genes from one life form and brought in the genes from a completely different life form. This is not hybridization or selective breeding, which does alter genes slowly over time, but they still stay within families. But here we're taking the genes from a fish or a bacteria or a virus and inserting it into the genes of, you know, a potato or an apple or a corn or whatever to create a completely new trait that didn't exist before. And so, for example, GMO salmon, which has been approved now for the United States, though it's still not in widespread use, farm salmon, they turn off the gene that tells them to stop growing. So they grow really, really, really fast. So then they farmed salmon can be sold more quickly. But they, if they ever get out into the ocean, they could wipe out the entire salmon population because they could have a breeding priority because they'll be bigger, faster. And so then all the other salmon could mate with them, and then they could take over the oceans very quickly. So, and then we'd have no more wild salmon left on Earth that wasn't genetically engineered. So this is an example of what could happen, right? But with most of the GMO crops, we have corn and soy and canola and sugar beets and cotton, and they've all been essentially genetically engineered for one or both of two traits. One is they produce the insecticide BT in every cell of the plant, so they're living pesticide factories. Certain bugs take a bite, their stomach splits open, and they die. And the other is that they are herbicide tolerant, so they can be sprayed with glyphosate or 2,4-D or other toxic herbicides, and the plant won't die, but the weeds will. So now we humans are consuming weed killer and BT in unprecedented quantities because of the GMOs in our food supply. Now, glyphosate, which is the primary active ingredient in Roundup, has been declared a probable carcinogen. It's a known endocrine disruptor, and it's also been patented as an antibiotic. So it kills bacteria. Monsanto did patent it as an antibiotic, yes. So there's a lot of thought that the explosion in food allergy rates and the digestive problems that we're seeing in such epidemic numbers could be connected to the GMOs in our food supply. So if you want to avoid GMOs, the top things you want to do are to look for corn, soy, canola, sugar, and cottonseed oil, and make sure that when you're consuming those products, they're organic or certified non-GMO. Organic is by definition non-GMO. But here's the thing, a lot of these products are turned into hyper-processed foods and they end up in all kinds of other things. So really you want to look for all those chemicals, all the processed foods with ingredients you don't know how to pronounce, because almost certainly, unless they're certified organic, they got GMOs in them. So those are the top things to look for. And now there's some GMO apples, and the Red Delicious, I believe, and there are some GMO potatoes starting to come onto the market, because those have been approved. So those are places where you start to need to go organic now. And obviously going non-GMO is great for this one specific issue, but organic is much greater, because non-organic food that's non-GMO could still be sprayed with all sorts of neurotoxic pesticides. Non-organic wheat is also now being sprayed with glyphosate because they're using it as a desiccant to dry the crop out before harvest. So in fact, wheat and oats both, and some of the other cereal crops. So it's getting more and more important now. If you do eat wheat, and I'm sure by the end of this weekend you may not be eating wheat, but if you do eat wheat, then make sure it's organic. It's awesome. A big deal.
The other thing is that, it's been unfortunately shot down so many times is labeling, right? And a lot of it is we don't have a choice. If somebody can't afford organic or they're buying, they don't have to label that there's GMO in it. And California tried, and Oregon. I mean, all these states have tried. I think the only one that passed it was New Hampshire or Vermont or
Vermont
something.
Vermont passed it. Yeah, I could tell a little story about that if you want. Do we have more questions there, or should I tell this story? Okay, I'll tell the story then. Okay. So this, and I'll kind of wrap with this. So, a few years back, you may recall, state after state was having ballot initiatives to label GMOs. And Washington was one of them. And there was an initiative called I-522 in the state of Washington calling on mandatory labeling of GMOs on packages. And it was very popular. Most people found the idea of knowing what was in their food appealing and wanted to know if their foods were genetically engineered. But then the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which is a kind of consortium of junk food companies, started investing heavily in fighting this initiative in the state of Washington. And they spent about $30 million fighting it. Monsanto chipped in a bunch as well. Ended up shattering state records for ballot initiative spending to fight any ballot initiative in the history of Washington by like several times. And in the end, they plastered the airwaves with an avalanche of ads saying that this would raise the price of groceries by $500. They like pulled that out of nowhere. I mean, labels don't cost anything just to stick a label on there, right? They were basically assuming, I guess, that everybody would stop buying that stuff and everybody would eat organic. And I'm thinking, what's so bad about that? But anyhow, they ended up putting so much fear into people that they tipped the scales and barely won by like you know, 20,000 votes, right? Like 50.1% of the vote or whatever it was in the end. Barely won. And I was feeling super disheartened that we lost in Washington. But then an interesting thing happened. The state attorney general revealed that there's something called campaign finance laws. And in the state of Washington, everybody has to reveal where the money comes from. And the Grocery Manufacturers Association hadn't revealed their donors. And the state attorney general said, where did you get your $30 million? And so they had to reveal it, and it was Coca-Cola and Nestle and Pepsi and all these other junk food companies. And they ended up suing the GMA. And it was recently resolved, and the GMA owed about $30 million to the state of Washington, which was the largest campaign finance fine in the history of the United States. It's basically sinking the GMA, along with the negative publicity. Yes. Yes. But before the lawsuit was over, I was realizing that, gosh, all of these companies were trying to hide. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? Then around that time, my son River, the ocean refuses no river. My son River and I were out shopping in a local natural food store, and there's an Odwalla mango tango, like, smoothie drink thing that, you know, you really shouldn't drink, but I was hot and tired, and I, like, reached for it, and my son River says, Coke, Odwalla's owned by Coke. And I'm like, yeah, so? He says, so you want to give your money to Coke? And I look at him, and I'm turning a little red, and I'm like, well, maybe if Coke makes money from selling Odwalla, they'll focus less on marketing Coke, and they'll focus more on marketing Odwalla, and we'll build a better world. And he's like, so you want to give your money to Coke? And I sheepishly put that drink back on the shelf. And then it hit me, oh my gosh, our Food Revolution Network community, we have 500,000 members, they don't buy a lot of Coke, but they buy Odwalla, and Zico tea. Coconut water, and Honest Tea, and maybe even vitamin water, and other natural brands that Coke owns. So we ended up, we launched a campaign, a boycott of Coca-Cola, and calling on them, and focusing on the natural brands they own, and calling on them to stop funding the fight against GMO labeling. And we got 300,000 people signing this petition, calling on Coke to make a change. And then we went to them and we said, hey, look, you all say you support transparency. It's in your mission statement. You say you support consumer empowerment. That's also in your mission statement. And yet here you are on the wrong side of history on this critical issue, fighting to keep the consumer in the dark. And we think that's out of keeping with your integrity. I'm imagining they had some, right? And we ended up, a friend of mine knew the founder of Honest Tea, which he was still owning or still running as a brand within the Coke company, and he had been one of the original pioneers of the GMO labeling movement. So I go to Seth Goldman, I'm like, look, we're boycotting your company and your brand, and we think you're great, and I want you to go to your bosses and tell them that we're costing you money and that their choices are costing you money. So next thing that happens is we get invited out to Washington, D.C., and to meet with senior leadership of Coca-Cola. So we went, and they said, you know what, we're tired of spending all this money fighting GMO labeling. It's not good for PR. That was their motivation, but anyway. But we're a small company. We can't make a change all by ourselves. And they said, why don't we get some partners together? So they brought leadership from Mars, Nestle, Coca-Cola, Pepsi, American Beverage Association. Also in the conversation was Kellogg's and General Mills. We brought leadership from Center for Food Safety, Food Revolution Network, Consumers Union, which produces consumer reports, and Just Label It. And we all sat together for a series of meetings over the course of about 2 years in Washington, D.C. And I was the one who facilitated these meetings. And our goal was to see if we could find some common ground. And it was an amazing experience, because there I was with senior vice presidents and senior leadership from some of the companies that I had grown up hating. I mean, here was Nestle. I don't know if you know about the baby infant formula scandal, but this is a company that, as standard practice, would give mothers in hospitals infant formula, just enough so that they would feed it to their babies with the contaminated water that's all they had available to them, and when they ran out of the free sample was about the time that their milk would have dried up. And then they would be dependent on buying this stuff, mothers in impoverished communities, and mixing it with polluted water when we all know breast is best. And you think about the public health impact of this and the economic impact on the poorest families in the world. And you think about the practice of giving those free samples to every baby as they walk out of that hospital, and I think it's criminal, right? Now, they've stopped that practice, but I grew up hearing about this story, and to me, Nestle was nothing I wanted any part of. But here I was with the senior VP of Nestle, and I realized she doesn't stay up all night trying to figure out how to kill kids. She's trying to make a living and play her part within a system that she is just a cog in a machine. And all of these people felt like cogs in a machine, and they all talked about mission statements and ethics and integrity and values, and you know what? They all have to find some way of justifying what they're doing. But here's the thing. If every company that does the right thing goes out of business, what hope do we have? Mm-hmm. And so if we can shift these ships just a little bit, just one degree, the impact is enormous. Maybe it's the Titanic, but still, if we can make a little shift, it can help a lot of people. Yeah. So as we had these conversations, we did find some common ground, and we realized that these food companies were sick and tired of fighting GMO labeling, but they didn't want to have to put a skull and crossbones on their products. And so we ended up coming up with a solution for a national solution on the GMO labeling issue that we all could agree on, and we had mutual attorneys working together to craft the legislation that the food companies were going to introduce to Congress. It would have been the first time in food movement history that major food brands and major food movement activists, would have come together on a shared legislation of major import, and we had a strategy for how to do it that would have worked. And then, just about then, the DARC Act passed. Deny Americans Right to Know is what we call it, which was a pseudo-GMO labeling initiative. It went through Congress, it was signed by the president, and it eviscerated GMO labeling for all practical purposes in the United States. So at that point, it became voluntary, and our little project became not something that actually bore fruit. But even so, some companies volunteered. So Mars announced, we're still labeling GMOs. And I reached out to the senior VP of Mars, and I said, thank you. And he said, we should have done this a long time ago. Our conversation spurred us to move forward and finally do the right thing. So they not only chose to voluntarily label when they use GMOs, but they also chose to phase out GMOs from a lot of their products. Now, I'm still not buying Mars products for a lot of obvious reasons, but I appreciate that they took that step.
Yeah.
And so, too, did General Mills and Kellogg's experiment with some GMO products and putting that on their product line. And now non-GMO certified products are a $30 billion industry in the United States.
Whoa.
$30 billion. It's gone from nothing to $30 billion in just the last 8 years. So we're seeing change happening. And a lot of these big food corporations have now got sub-brands that are non-GMO certified. And I'll tell you, these folks taught me something profound, which is that if we're going to truly change the world, it's going to take everybody playing some part, right? And some of us will be the radical activists that will say, you know what, the entire food system is sick, and we need to change it from the ground up. And other people will get McDonald's to use a little bit less hydrogenated oils in its French fries. And you know what, at the end of the day, there might be less sick kids when they do that. So step by step, we all have a part to play. And whether it's big institutional change for micro changes or it's small-scale, radical, grassroots transformation, we all have a part to play. And I say that whatever you are, whatever your health history, whatever your social context, whatever relationships you are in, whoever you interact with, whoever you influence, you have a part to play. You have something you can do to be a part of this revolution. And when you do it not just for your integrity and your conscience and your values. You do it for all life on earth. Woo-hoo. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It looks like we have one last question. You've been waiting so long, Bobby. Go ahead.
Oh, do we have time for that?
Yeah, one last one.
It's so quick, because it wasn't a question. It was going to be a statement, but you've changed the nature of it. Because I became, I came of age as a hippie at 25, and I will be 77 in December. And I've either been practicing this kind of, whatever you want to call healthcare or whatever, for about 40 years. My original thought was, you know, we had one thing that I don't think people have today. We had a group movement that was physically could be seen. You just had to walk down the street with the right clothes on, and we all changed our diet. This is not the time we have now. Now it's a very individual movement. So my original statement was going to be that I live also in a country where GMO rice is forced, was forced by the government, that we're now trying to change back to traditional. But the thing is, I was going to say, just don't buy it. Vote with your pocketbook. And also, did you think that sending petitions and emails would make a difference? But you presented a middle of a road that I hadn't really thought about, because I'm really definitely started organic and kind of like, let's just pull it back. But apparently you think that is not a good idea, and maybe for a good reason. So that was just
what's not a good idea?
To actually just not purchase any of their products as long as they're like that.
No, I'm not saying that. I think you can absolutely, we need to boycott the bad stuff and we need to boycott the good stuff.
Right.
So invest in the good things that you believe in. I'm saying that for the mainstream consumer, choosing to eat food that's a little bit less bad is still a step. But I think that the farther, you know, if you're trying to create a tipping point, you know, the farther out you go, in a sense, the more leverage you have, right, on the fulcrum. Right. So the more in integrity with your values you can live, the better, without losing your connection with other people.
Right.
You know? But if we all go live in a cave somewhere and grow all our own food and drink nothing but pristine water and have no interaction with the world because we have no technology and no internet and no social life, then we may not have much impact.
Yeah.
Right? So you find your place, basically. Right.
I wasn't really suggesting that, and I'll just
I understand.
End by saying that I'm a proud member of your food revolution.
Yay. Yay. Thank you so much.
Who else here is a member of the food revolution? Woo-hoo.
All right.
Awesome. And if you're not, just go to foodrevolution.org and, you know, get involved.
Yes.
And so I want to say that, well, Ocean wrote this book, 31 Day Food Revolution, and it's an awesome book. It's loaded with resources. He spent months and months researching to make sure, and you could hear by the way he speaks, he's very well versed and he knows the studies. And so it's an excellent book, but in addition to the information, it's a great book for folks who are just getting started, especially because it's a 31-day plan of do this today, do this the next day. So how they can ease into something different. So he has very limited number of copies in the back, and he'll be in the back to sign them so you can buy a book, cash only, what is it, $25?
$25. Yeah.
And we are buying one to give as a raffle ticket for someone lucky in the audience. So you get to pick.
This is going to 96000016.
Who's got it? Who's got 00016?
00016.
00016.
And you have to be in the room so you can see why skipping out is not a good deal, right?
Check, check. 00016.
Going once, all going twice.
Going,
okay.
Right.
Okay. Okay. Another one.
All right. This one is going to 00012.
Who's
one,
that?
Two.
00012. We have a winner.
And take your book to the back table, and Ocean will sign it.
I'll sign it for you. Yes, I will.
And then anybody else that wants to get a book, they're back at that back table. I highly encourage you to do that.
Great.
I'll let you give it to them.
All right. Yeah, and I'll say real quickly that 31 chapters, each one ends with action steps you can take, and it kind of goes through a journey. So part one is detoxify. It's getting rid of the bad stuff, and all the chapters relate to that. And part two is nourish, saying yes to the good stuff that's been scientifically proven to be helpful. Part three is gather. It's about the social side of food and building tribe and community and relationships and influencing others without coming off like a wacko radical. And then part four is transform. It's how you can be part of the revolution on the planet and change the world. And the spoiler alert is it's a whole lot easier to change the world than you ever imagined.
Okay, tell them why it's 31.
31. Well, 31 steps to health will bring you more pleasure and more joy than 31 flavors of ice cream.